The Tom Woods Show, episode 2115.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey, everybody. I'm giving away three free courses from my Liberty Classroom. One of them is ex-Marxist Michael Rechtenwald teaching you about critical theory so you can understand leftism and fight it better, as well as our course on how Alexander Hamilton screwed up America and the history of the conservative and libertarian movements. Check it out at 3freecourses.com. Hey, everybody. Tom Woods here. I am delighted to be joined by our old friend, Gene Epstein. Now, Gene has credentials as long as his arm. I could take the whole episode running you through his extraordinary career, culminating in his work at Barron's, the nation's premier financial publication, where he was economics and book review editor. But he is now the director of the Soho Forum, the outstanding debate series in Manhattan that covers issues of interest to libertarians and really to all people. I wanted to talk to Gene today, though, about an issue that's come up quite a bit over the years that I've been in this thing. Every once in a while, there's an article that says that the United States dollar is in some kind of danger of losing its reserve currency status. So what I want to talk about is, what does that mean? And secondly, if that were to happen, what would the consequences be for the average person? Let's just answer this question once and for all with Gene. Gene Epstein, welcome back to the show.
Good to be back, Tom. And again, I thank you for all your support for my Soho Forum. What a pleasure to be the subject of another Tom Woods prank when you and Jenna showed up unexpectedly at my last debate held at the Sheen Center in downtown Manhattan. You love pranks, Tom, and I love to be the subject of those pranks. It was great to see you, as well as to see you the next day for lunch. How was your time in Manhattan, Tom? Because I want to hear you promote Manhattan as a place for people to visit and to watch a Soho Forum. You were here for how many days?
I was just there for about 3.5 days, so not very long. But I will say there was more life in the place than I expected to see.
And a lot of life, yes, indeed.
I mentioned that when we left your house, we just walked along and did what I love to do in New York, which is to walk by a random restaurant that just looks interesting. I know nothing about it. Just looks interesting. Let's just walk in and eat.
Yeah.
And the place was just bustling and nobody asked us a thing. But the one thing, of course, as you know, that still is a source of irritation for me are the restrictions around Broadway shows. And I love the theater, so that still breaks my heart. But so much of what I love in the city, I got a chance to experience again. And there, you know, there were more masks than there should be, but not as many as you would think.
Yeah.
So it wasn't so bad.
Yes. Well, I'm glad you came. And I want to say that I've succumbed to Broadway because I had a hunger to see a few shows. It is indeed true that at one of the venues I went to, in fact, when I saw The Music Man, I enjoyed that show very much. It's an old warhorse of a musical. It's got a lot of good songs. I probably had somewhat lower standards because I'd been, it was like a drink of water after a long time in the desert because so little had been happening with respect to theater. And they were indeed going crazy, where normally if the lights go down, you can lower your mask and nobody knows. But those crazies were even noticing that my mask was down when the lights were down, and they were bugging me about putting my mask back up above my nose. So that was bad. But most of the Broadway theaters now, by the way, are not requiring vax proof. And of two others that I went to where I saw a couple of decent shows, they were not policing you so that what I typically do, of course, is just lower the mask to below my chin once the lights go down. I just want to mention that for those of you who want to follow in Tom's footsteps and visit Manhattan, especially around the time of Monday, May 9th, when the Soho Forum will have its next debate. Now, at our venue at the Sheen Center on Bleecker Street, there are no vax requirements, no mask requirements. Because the crowd of people is so large, it's a 260-seat hall, there's really no room for a reception afterwards. So we've gotten in the habit, my wife and I, of having the reception at our place, just two blocks uptown. We have a very large loft apartment. Tom, you witnessed it. It's got a, it's big and cavernous, plenty of room for guests, and no vax or mask requirements there either. So it's a great evening that I know you had, Tom, attending our debate and showing up at a reception. That's May 9th will be the next one. It's going to start a little late, 7 p.m. Monday, May 9th. In this case, we are flying in from London, a journalist named Julie Bindel. She's British. She's written a book called The Pimping of Prostitution, Abolishing the Sex Work Myth. She's going to defend the resolution, a good society should criminalize the purchase of sex. So the Soul Forum is finally having our debate on sex work, a classic libertarian issue. She's going to defend that resolution. A good society should criminalize the purchase of sex. Elizabeth Nolan Brown, a journalist at Reason, who's written a lot about this subject as well, will take the negative, will defend the negative on that resolution. Monday, May 9th, go on our website, thesoulform.org, for tickets. I'll be moderating, and of course, I'll be hosting the reception afterwards in our home. Thanks for allowing me to deliver that plug, Tom.
All right. Well, my pleasure, Gene. Okay. Now let's dig in here into our topic.
Heavy stuff,
I've got a main topic to cover, but then we'll probably have some time for just a few random questions. But because the topic comes up so much, because you see the occasional headline that seems to suggest that there might be some jeopardy for the status of the dollar as the world's reserve currency, people begin to speculate on what that would mean.
Yeah.
So whether or not that ever happens, it's still interesting to speculate on what it would mean. But I want to walk through this simply and for the beginner. So before we even speculate on this, let's talk about what exactly does it mean that the U.S. is the world reserve currency? And let's even begin with how did this phenomenon come about in the first place?
Yeah. Well, I think it's like sort of too fancy a term, but I did a little preparation when you alerted me yesterday to doing a little something on this. The issue has come up. People have asked me about it as well. And so I have some important thoughts to convey. But getting to your question, Tom, about specifically what the reserve currency is, a typical definition that I looked up, which I'll read right now, is serviceable enough. A reserve currency is a large amount of currency held by central banks and major financial institutions, and indeed traders as well, to use for international transactions. A reserve currency reduces exchange rate risk, since there's no need for a country to exchange its currency for the reserve currency to do a trade. I'm going to get to your question about how it developed, but I want to plunge in to just sort of set my special framework for this. It's really something else that is manifested in a way that I think is clearer to, could be clearer to people in your audience. It's that we have found, or that the Bank for International Settlements keeps reporting that most recently, based upon their survey done in April 2019, that nearly 90% of all trading in the foreign exchange market, and at that point it was like up to $6 billion a day, in nearly 90% of cases, the dollar is on one side or the other. The dollar is on one side or the other. So that really, it's the medium of exchange for international trade, for speculation and for purchase of goods and services. That's the way I would say, in layman's term, is what we're really talking about as a reserve currency. And since it is the medium of exchange, 90% of all trades, or nearly 90%, at least that was true in April 2019, we'll get to updates in a moment, clearly you're going to hold some of that currency in your account balance. It's kind of a classic Austrian point. The dollar is what the world uses to buy things with. Things are priced in dollars. And then, of course, central banks, as I would put it, central banks follow suit because that's what the markets do. Central banks, of course, have to finance their own government to buy things in the market. And so they hold the dollar as a medium of exchange because it's got to be at the ready to make purchases or to buy stocks in our capital market. Now, another point to put in perspective about this is that U.S. role in world trade is far smaller than 90%. What the U.S. exports is worth less than 9% of world trade. What the U.S. imports is worth less than 13%. We are, to a great degree, a self-sufficient economy, and therefore the U.S. role in world trade is less than 15%. It's relatively small. China's role in world trade is larger than ours, and not surprisingly, it exports and imports far more. Now, why do I make that point that our role in world trade is less than 15% when the role of the dollar is nearly 90%? It's because, indeed, you might expect that the dollar would be on like 15% of all trades, maybe 20% because of capital markets transactions in our stock market and our bond market, but 90%? No. 90% is the reason why the dollar is the medium of exchange. Now, my hobby horse about this, which might surprise your listeners, is that I use this example as a demonstration that if you left it to the market would choose one currency, one kind of money as a medium of exchange. The balkanization of currencies comes from nation states. They print their own money and then they force their citizens to use their own money. But when it comes to the relatively free market in the international marketplace, people have short pencils. They want to use one currency. That's the network effect of money. And I believe that that's demonstrated by the habits of the international marketplace. Now, when I make this point, I'm running counter to a typical argument that's made that the origins of this phenomenon were really that our U.S. government was forcing the world to use our dollar. It's had a huge plot to force it to use our dollar. And I believe that that analysis makes a little bit too much out of the intelligence of the American government. And it also, again, ignores the natural forces of a marketplace to use one currency as a medium of exchange. In other words, it's basically a powerful market phenomenon. Now, you ask, how did it arise? Well, here, perhaps you want to correct me if I'm going to be a little bit too sketchy, but of course, it arose from the Bretton Woods Agreement post-World War II, the U.S.
Right, exactly. So let's talk about, first of all, why did anybody feel the need to establish the Bretton Woods Agreement? What was the problem that existed that Bretton Woods was going to solve?
I believe that, again, I'm going to give it a relatively benign interpretation, even though, of course, there was an idea that the U.S., on the part, obviously, of those in charge of the U.S. government, that it was great for the U.S. to dominate world trade. But I believe that it was basically came from a certain understanding that gold still mattered. It was not in favor of gold because, as you know, the Bretton Woods Agreement said that the U.S. dollar would be recognized as a reserve currency, but those dollars would be redeemable for gold on the part of anybody trading in the international market. It was slightly absurd in one sense because the ownership of gold had been outlawed in the early 1930s. Ownership by U.S. citizens was outlawed, but the U.S. was supposedly ready to redeem in gold if you held dollars, and in that way, it would be sort of back up on the world currencies. I think it was a vague and sort of ill-thought-out plan for making global trading rational again, and it was fated to die. I know, I mean, you might have a different view than mine about that, but I believe that it was that seemed sensible at the time, that the world needed a single currency. It had originally thought that gold was the lingua franca, was the currency, and the U.S. stepped in with its dollars to back it in gold. But I don't really believe that there was a consistent and very pronounced desire on the part of one U.S. administration after another to make sure the dollar was dominant. I don't think people are that smart. I like to tell the classically true story that John F. Kennedy, supposedly a fairly bright guy, could never get it straight which agency of government handled monetary policy. He was given a mnemonic because at the time, William McChesney Martin was head of the Fed, so that M told him that the Federal Reserve handles monetary policy. I mention that only because I don't think there was any kind of real plot. There was just sort of some vague desire for world trade to remain stable. John Maynard Keynes had something to do with this agreement. I'm wondering why they were so foolish as to think that the U.S. would continue to redeem the dollar in gold, because, as you know, that stopped in the early 1970s under Richard Nixon. I don't know if you regard that as a sufficient account of what happened. You tell me how you might want to correct it, Tom.
Or what I don't want to correct it. I just want to add to it a little bit.
Okay,
so
sure.
The fact that the U.S. dollar, like we live in the society whose currency is the world reserve currency.
Yeah.
What kind of advantage does that give the U.S. regime as opposed to the governments of other countries?
Well, you see, the interesting part of that is that it's actually a two-edged sword. It just gets back to the classic point about whether a strong dollar is good or a weak dollar is good. It obviously means that the dollar has an upward bias, that it tends to be strong. Why? Because people do have to buy dollars. They have to buy dollars simply to transact in the marketplace. So that's a kind of purchasing floor for the dollar. It means that the dollar is relatively strong. And that's what it does. And that is obviously an advantage on the part of the U.S. government that might want to buy something from abroad. It's an advantage on the part of those private sector people who want to buy something from abroad. It's an advantage for tourists who want to travel abroad. They have dollars, so they can buy other currencies on the cheap. But obviously, a strong dollar is a disadvantage for exporters. It's even to some degree a disadvantage for the U.S. government if it wants to sell its bonds abroad, because that means if the dollar is relatively expensive to purchase, you have to purchase dollars in order to purchase U.S. bonds. You have to purchase dollars in order to purchase U.S. goods. And therefore, a strong dollar is not good news for those who want to export.
So back up. Are you saying that the very status of the dollar as the world reserve currency gives it a strength that it wouldn't otherwise have?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Again, I thank you, Tom, for you're always policing me to make sure I keep it simple. And that's a great help. Of course, all it means is that if there are billions of dollars held abroad, how are they acquired? Well, you have to keep purchasing dollars in order to transact in the marketplace. So therefore, it's not just that people have to purchase dollars in order to buy things from the U.S. It's that people have to purchase dollars in order to buy things from anybody. Because if country A or country B, I'm not going to make up a country, but two countries, but we'll set aside Russia and China for the moment because they're trying to get out of that. But if one country buys something from another country and neither country is the U.S., most likely the purchase is going to occur in dollars. If a private company sells something abroad and that private company is a European company, it's selling to buyers in Brazil, most likely that purchase is going to occur through dollars. Because as I said, the Bank for International Settlements found that nearly 90% of all trading, at least as of April 2019, when it did its last survey, a dollar was on the other side. Somebody was using a dollar. And that 90% is so totally out of proportion to the amount of goods and services the U.S. buys and sells itself. And therefore, that's a buying floor. You've got to buy dollars in order to transact in the marketplace. And so that's essentially a floor put under the dollar that adds buying pressure to the dollar and keeps the dollar relatively strong.
I'm actually thinking it's probably the dumbest observation I've made in 2,100 episodes. But
lay it on me, Tom. I'm looking forward to it. Go ahead.
I don't know. It seems almost like there's an analogy to the English language.
Yeah.
It's not like there aren't other languages in the world, but if you speak English, it's going to make your life as a traveler internationally way, way easier. In Stockholm, they'll speak English. In Vienna, they'll speak English. I mean, you can be assured of it. There'll be some who don't, but there are massive advantages to speaking English. So it's like the world's reserve language in a way, because it facilitates a lot of international communication.
Tom, you know I'm hard on you if you say something dumb, but you know you can trust me when I tell you that I think that that's a very clever, very insightful observation. There definitely is an analogy. It strikes me as strange when I went to it. At Barron's, where I was for many years, I would often meet with the international traders. And one of them in particular, a Swiss guy, said, my French is so rusty. I don't have to talk French anymore to French people. I used to, but now it's English. The dominant, when you and I were young, and even when you were young, Tom, and you're only 49, it wasn't so dominant. But it's really over the last 30 years or so that English has become more and more dominant in the world. I had friends who lived in Amsterdam for a long time, and they just never learned the local language because they never had to. And indeed, that too is a kind of a network effect. The more people speak it, the more people will want to speak it. And so it builds on itself. So there is indeed an analogy with the English language. And I like the analogy especially because it's voluntary. It's not forced by government. So what I'm tilting against is the argument that the status of the dollar as the reserve currency is a political issue, that it's been imposed by government. Yes, there was some idea of the strong dollar. Yes, the Bretton Woods Agreement did have that basic philosophy behind it. But it would never have happened but for the fact that the world likes to have a single currency, that the free market likes to have a single currency. And as I say, I use it as an example against those who tell me, not infrequently, that if you leave it to the market, there'll be like 90 different competing currencies. Look at all those cryptocurrencies out there. It's going to be a big mess if you leave it to the market. And I like to use this example of the relatively free international market to demonstrate that they are wrong. The market has a short pencil. The market wants a single currency. If everybody's using the currency, everybody else wants to. There's a powerful network effect with respect to the dollar. Now, what also, of course, helped that even though, let's get to the next part of that story, I alluded briefly to the fact that the U.S. government was undisciplined and the U.S. government was running out of gold. And foreigners were redeeming, and they clearly didn't have enough gold on hand in order to meet all those redemptions. In other words, backing up the guarantee for Bretton Woods was that if a foreigner holds dollars, those dollars could be redeemed for gold. So this was beginning to become unworkable. And by the early 1970s, or 71, I think, 72, Nixon, I don't even know if he knew quite what he was doing, he closed the gold window. He declared that the U.S. could no longer redeem in gold. However, by and large, the dollar was still out there. The U.S. ran deficits, and deficits mean that more and more dollars get out there. An additional factor, of course, that we've left out is that some economies like Panama dollarized. They recognized de facto that the dollar was being used. Another part of the story is to point out that 90% of all the cash out there, a lot of it $100 bills, but even smaller bills, is held abroad and used abroad for cash transactions. So there is a tendency for the dollar to dominate. And I think basically it's a natural tendency. However screwed up our economy is, it's always compared to what? One of the most valuable things about the Economic Freedom Index, especially as put out by the Fraser-Cato people, which is a very objective index, is that it shows that there are degrees of capitalism in the world, that Russia may be capitalist, but it ranks very low in terms of its free market orientation. The U.S. ranks relatively high. It's a large economy as well. So there's a natural tendency for its dollars to be used. On top of that, maybe I'm packing too much in here. Again, don't forget that it runs trade deficits. And so when you run a trade deficit, it naturally means that people end up with your dollars, and it's therefore been issuing dollars to the world that way in a natural way. And I'm belaboring this point only to say that my main belief is that whatever the stirrings are about the U.S. losing its status as a reserve currency, I think that they are way premature. I don't see any evidence that it's something that's just around the corner. But we can talk about how it could happen 10 to 15 years from now. But I think it's, even given the problems the U.S. economy faces, I think it's unlikely to happen in the relatively intermediate future.
That was my feeling about this as well. But as I say, since the topic keeps coming up, I wanted to talk about it. So there are a couple more things I want to ask you. I do want to get to, in fact, why don't we start with this one? If this were to happen, how would the average American feel it just beyond seeing it in the headlines? How would it affect his life?
Well, again, I go back to the point that a much more rational world, we all would use the same currency. We'd use the same currency domestically. We'd use it internationally. We wouldn't have all these crazy exchange rates. But with that said, the point is that the dollar would definitely weaken. And of course, when the dollar weakens, that means that it's more expensive for Tom to take his trips abroad. Then the dollar is worth less in relation to other currencies, because that buying pressure that puts upward lift on the dollar is going to be gone, because the dollar will no longer be bought in order to purchase things in the world. And so a weaker dollar is going to mean that, but it obviously would be good news for anybody in the export business. You'll sell more. It would be somewhat inflationary, at least to the extent that the dollar declines, because it obviously will mean that whatever we import is going to cost more in dollars. So that's not good either. But once the dollar settles, then there'll be, if it doesn't even get into a trading range, then it won't be felt in any traumatic way. I should emphasize that, as with everything in a marketplace, even with respect to exchange rates, the only real problem is the abrupt change. And abrupt changes, unfortunately, do happen. That's part of what business cycle theory is all about, Austrian business cycle theory, an abrupt change that the market has got to adjust to. In the meantime, there's unemployment. Similarly, if the dollar were to plummet by 30% in a month, then it would roil all kinds of market relationships, and it would be problematic. But if the dollar declines slowly, then the adjustment could occur. So I don't regard it as a disaster for the world, but other problems could arise. Certainly, you could get into what one doom and gloomster coined as the Dow dollar death spiral, that the our stock market declines, all the foreigners who own our bonds and own our stocks start dumping because what they're holding in dollars becomes far less valuable. And then as they dump our stocks, they're dumping our dollars. The dollar continues to decline. Our stock market continues to decline. So abrupt changes of that sort could happen. I guess I've given a kind of complicated answer to the question, but just to summarize, a weak dollar in itself is good news for exporters. It's bad news for importers. It's good news for tourists who want to come to this country. It's good news for the tourist industry in this country to attract foreigners, but it's bad news for American tourists who want to travel abroad. An abrupt change, however, a violent change within the space of 6 months or 9 months or 6 weeks, that obviously creates adjustment problems. So I hope that is a reasonable answer to your question.
It is a more than reasonable answer. Okay. Now I want to ask you to walk us through slowly, step by step, exactly why a strong dollar is bad for exporters. It seems like a strong dollar, which simply means the dollar commands a lot of goods, is a good thing. So on the surface, I want you to explain to me why I would feel like this, because usually something that's good for me is good for everybody. But a strong dollar is good for me.
Okay.
Generally, right? I can command a lot of goods in the marketplace. Walk me through step by simple step why it's bad for exporters. And then I want to run my objection to this analysis by you, and I want your answer. I think I know your answer, but let's start walking through the steps. I sell widgets to the rest of the world, and the dollar is really strong. Why am I losing sleep over that?
Okay, well, maybe I can rephrase your question slightly and say, let's say that the dollar strengthens. If a strong dollar is good, then a very strong dollar is even better, right?
So yeah. I'm sticking with that story until you tell me otherwise.
Right. Okay. But Tom, okay. The point is that clearly, if you are selling widgets to the rest of the world, and the Japanese yen is a confusing way of talking. I looked up the yen recently. The yen is actually very weak, by the way. The dollar has strengthened against the yen. The dollar has gone up by 30% against the yen. So that means that if Japanese buyers want to buy your widgets, Tom, they're going to have to pay 30% more, because they're going to have to buy dollars with their yen and pay 30% more for their dollars. Therefore, that will mean that even though the prices you're charging in dollars remain the same, to the Japanese buyer, it's going to cost 30% more. And because it costs 30% more, some of them are going to find it too expensive, and you're going to lose some of those people who buy your widgets from Japan. Isn't that obvious enough, Tom? Yeah.
Okay. But I guess the way I'm looking at it is, let's imagine we had a barter economy.
Oh, okay.
Because what's happening here, like, nothing real has changed, right? The number of widgets I have hasn't changed. The other country's lack of widgets hasn't changed.
Okay.
So why wouldn't this weird fluctuation of one currency against another, why wouldn't that eventually adjust to the reality of the situation, which is that the number of widgets is still the same? The economic conditions are still the same. It's just governments fiddling with their currencies. But why wouldn't the market eventually sort that out and everything go back to normal the way it was 10 minutes ago? Like, why would there be a lasting problem for exporters when in the physical world of real stuff, nothing has changed?
Well, that just gets to the point that, as I alluded to earlier, however briefly, that the foreign exchange markets are not really
instantaneous.
They're not a free market phenomenon. They're the idea that in this global marketplace that's so interlinked, where you could place a Zoom call to Japan right now, it would be a little late there, but you get somebody on the phone. The fact that we live in sort of in a global village, it's absurd to have so many different currencies. And as I said, to some degree, that's the reason why the U.S. has a reserve currency, because people just prefer to trade in dollars. So therefore, I guess maybe this doesn't satisfy you, Tom, to say that if we did, obviously in a barter economy, that would have problems of its own. But
right, but
as you know, because then we wouldn't have the coincidence of wants, because that Japanese person...
Yeah, I'm not advocating barter.
I know,
I'm just saying that if we get money out of the picture, we see that the important thing is that real conditions are identical.
Yeah, okay.
So who cares about governments fiddling? I mean, eventually the prices will just readjust somehow so that everything is restored to its original balance. I don't see this problem. I don't understand this problem.
Well, you know, as a matter of fact, right now, I haven't looked into it enough. As you know, my wife Asako is Japanese, and so I take, you know, sometimes an unusual interest in this. And I've noticed the Japanese yen is greatly weakened. I haven't even looked into why. Now it's lost value. The dollar is about 10 to 20% more expensive. Now, there are so many irrationalities that govern the way the dollar is traded against the yen. So that situation could persist for quite a while. But you're saying that eventually it will right itself? Well, if the Japanese government, let's say, I don't quite know whether this is the case, is the Japanese government printing a lot of yen? And it prints a lot of yen, puts a lot of yen supply out there, and the yen weakens against the dollar. So maybe the Japanese government is at fault. But let me broaden the point and touch on it this way, Tom. It's the Austrians who have taught the mainstream economists, although the mainstream economists don't want to listen, although to some degree maybe they're listening a little bit, that money is not a neutral veil. That when the U.S. government prints money, it's not as though it's not helicopter money that falls on everybody at the same time. It changes the ball game. The government has the power to change the ball game and to warp market relationships by printing money. Money is not a veil. You know the old expression that money is supposed to be a veil and that you might as well just think in terms of barter in the marketplace? The Austrians have made the point that money is not a veil and that you really have to ask who gets the money first and how does it seep through the economy? Aren't you really asking another question, which is that if we're facing price inflation now, then some prices are going up more than others. And all of that is causing all kinds of adjustment problems for people. And you would presumably then make the same kind of argument, Tommy. You'd say, well, what the heck does that make any difference in domestic purchases of goods and services? Under barter, this wouldn't be a problem, right? So you see the point that foreign exchange rates and the printing of money and the distortions that arise from it can severely warp market relations that might otherwise be relatively normal. Because indeed, Tom, if in a rational world, there would be only one currency, maybe it would be gold, maybe it would be Bitcoin, there would be no way to fiddle with the relationship between you, the widget seller, and the purchaser in Japan who wants to buy your widgets. That purchaser in Japan would be using that Bitcoin currency. And while, of course, Bitcoin and gold are going to have some ruffling effect on market relationships, the fact that they are a convenient medium of exchange is overwhelmingly advantageous. But by and large, the very barter relationship that you think is normal would prevail, but not in a world in which governments are fiddling with money supply all the time, and where suddenly the Japanese yen can be worth 15% less than it was a month or two ago. That's a world of nation states. That's an irrational world. So maybe that helps with your question, Tom. Even though I take it, you understand the math, that if the U.S. dollar appreciates by 30% against the yen, it's going to be 30% more expensive, at least for the time being, for Japanese buyers to afford those widgets, and you're going to lose some of your business as a result.
All right. Well, then I guess what's bothering me is I love the Frederick Bastiat formulation, economic harmonies. I like the idea that the buyer and the seller, in a way, are of one mind. You know, they both want the same thing, ultimately.
Yeah.
That the lender and the borrower actually are harmonious. They're not enemies of each other. But in this scenario, it seems to me that exporters would have to be rooting for a destructive domestic monetary policy, because it would be in their interest. And so no longer do we have economic harmonies. We have one particular sector that is going to be advocating for policies that would hurt everybody else in the country, but would benefit them. This is an exception to the rule of economic harmonies.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, everybody can prosper if the currency stays stable. But for exporters, for them to get a real shot in the arm, we need to debase the currency. Well, then these are terrible people. I mean, what?
Well,
I mean, can that really be the whole analysis?
Well, in a way, you know, you've touched on the original idea of mercantilism, that you get rich, you know, the crazy philosophy of mercantilism, you get rich by selling and never by buying. You sell, you bring in gold. So there too, you're talking in those terms, so to speak, but I can't deny your point. You're filled with fascinating reflections, Tom, and I've got to pause a moment and think. Look, I believe in emphasizing the idea of the harmony of the marketplace. But then again, certainly, for example, you know, if you were in the business of selling oil, Tom, to use an example, selling crude oil, you want to see the price rise, right? So it's not good for most of us are buyers of crude oil, and most of us are buyers of energy, and we want to see a cheaper price. And in the broad scheme of things, the marketplace does make things increasingly cheaper. But with respect to the one thing that you were in the business of selling, you'd want to see a higher price. My point then is, couldn't we posit a lot of different exceptions to that same point about harmony, that there are certain contrary interests that people have in different marketplaces?
Yes, yes, yes. Okay, I concede that. I guess from now on, my view would be, if I find out somebody's an exporter, I don't care what his views on monetary policy are.
Okay.
Okay, because he is gaming the system for his own personal advantage.
Yeah. But, you know, but his power, yeah, okay. But, you know, some of them are nice.
His power is very limited. I grant you
that. Nice people, Tom, and so anyway. And of course, you want to, look, you're a world traveler, Tom. You got all these plans to travel, and you like the reserve currency status. Now that you know the reserve currency status causes a lot of extra buying of dollars, which tends to keep the dollar strong, that's good for you, Tom, as a tourist, because it means you can travel abroad and pay less because the dollars you're using are relatively stronger relation to the domestic currencies that you're purchasing in order to do this travel. So that's good for you too, Tom. I wanted to mention, I did look at the usual suspects in this sense. I reviewed all the statistics that are around there for what's happening to the dollar recently. There was a story that everybody latched upon that was released by the IMF about the share of U.S. dollar reserves held by central banks falling to 59%. There was a big item about that. And that was as of fourth quarter 2020. Well, the fourth quarter 2021 numbers are out, and it's still at 59%. It really hasn't changed. So whatever is happening very slowly. 59% of all U.S. dollar reserves held by the central bank are dollars, and that's still a pretty high number. The other part of it is that if the reserve status of the U.S. dollar were being threatened, you'd begin to see it in exchange rates. Any measure of the U.S. exchange rate is actually higher rather than lower than a year ago. Although with respect to following the numbers, I would be especially curious to get the release from the Bank for International Settlements. They have done a survey as of April of this year of all transactions in the marketplace, and they're going to release it in September. I believe that they'll probably find the same result, that maybe 90% of all trades, the dollar is on the other side. I'm waiting for that result. But just backing up again, it's 59% still in terms of U.S. dollar reserves, just as it was a year ago. The dollars, according to any measure, the dollar is actually stronger than it was a year ago. So I would look for those indicators if I were really concerned about the threats to the dollar's reserve status. Also, the most recent figures show holdings of U.S. treasuries, one-third of U.S. treasuries that are held by the public, one-third is held abroad, and Japan and China each hold over $1 trillion worth still to this day. So I see nothing in the numbers that show any real decline in interest on the part of foreigners in the dollar based upon the range of numbers that I've just cited. I seem to recall, Tom, that on your show, something came up about Saudi Arabia and the role of the petrodollar. You know, Saudi Arabia is a very minor player in the treasury market. It owns a little over $100 billion worth of treasuries, while Japan owns $1.3 trillion and China owns $1.1 trillion. And that doesn't even include what Hong Kong and Taiwan own. So that has come up at times, some sort of interest in the petrodollar and in Saudi Arabia, but they have pretty much receded into a relative unimportance in the market for dollars. So I wanted to latch upon that. Where do we go from here, Tom? You've had some interesting insights. Just to wrap it up, but to look to the future, I do see 10, 15 years down the road, continuing proliferation of U.S. debt, very logical warnings on the part of the Congressional Budget Office that it can become extremely expensive to service that debt. Right now, the crisis the Federal Reserve faces is that if it increases the short-term interest rate by too much, quote unquote, too much, it's going to make it very expensive for the U.S. to finance its debt, because it, financing, of course, means the interest rate it pays on that debt. So I see all kinds of problems down the road for the U.S. economy and the U.S. dollar. But I believe that the U.S. economy itself has not been defeated by its own government yet. And I don't think it's going to happen over the next couple of years. Although, let's talk about this 5 years from now, Tom, and then I might see things differently.
Okay, so to summarize your position, if I had to in one sentence, the loss of the reserve currency status on the part of the dollar is highly unlikely to occur in the immediate future, but that even if it did, it would not be the catastrophic event that some people fear. Is that
although again, let me add that a lot of things actually do happily happen slowly. If there was a suddenly some kind of 30%, 40% collapse in the dollar, a lot of export and import relationships would be affected. A lot of capital market relationships would be affected. And so that could cause a wrench. So again, it's only that it depends upon the speed of the transition. A slow transition to a decline in the reserve status of the dollar would not be disastrous. It would change the ballgame slowly enough for markets to adjust. And I should emphasize as well that all of my readings of the current numbers, holding of treasuries, the exchange value of the dollar in world markets, the reserves held by central banks, all of those numbers are holding and showing no signs as yet of a decline in the reserve status of the dollar. So that's another indication that it doesn't seem to be happening in terms of the numbers that I reviewed. But again, going back to it, no, it's not going to be a disaster unless it happens abruptly. And sometimes things do happen abruptly.
Okay, very good. So Gene Epstein, everybody, Gene should be followed. You can follow him on Twitter at Gene Soho Forum. But more importantly, is actually attending one of Gene's events in person. And you can get the details. You can also watch do you have a live stream? I know you discontinued it. Did you bring it back?
Oh, yeah, no. We've retained the live stream, actually. We actually don't get a whole lot of interest in live stream. We get fewer than 100 people, but we don't mind. Of course, the main way in which we don't mind selling some live stream tickets, so that's fine too. You can live stream it. You know, I love the party. I'm happy that we no longer have to do vaccine mask mandates. I'm happy that now a lot of people are coming. So I urge you to give New York a try and come visit. You can live stream. But then, of course, as well, all our debates are available on video and on podcast. And again, to my continual surprise, my debate with Richard Wolff, I appeared on your show to discuss that debate. It took place in late 2019. It just recently surpassed 3.5 million YouTube views. So that's been our most successful debate in terms of attention it's gotten on YouTube. We had another one on Bitcoin. That was with Peter Schiff, as a matter of fact, with Eric Voorhees. That's gotten 1 million YouTube views. So our debates live on YouTube and on podcasts. That's the Soulform Debates podcast. And you can catch all of our 62 debates on video or podcasts if you just go into thesoulform.org.
Okay, so the SoHoForum.org is the website. I'll link to that. I always do on the show notes page. That's TomWoods.com/2115. Thanks, Gene. Looking forward to the next time we see each other.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye, Tom.
All right, that's going to do it for today. This weekend, I am looking forward to the big supporting listeners party that I'm holding. That has been sold out for months and months. So if you are a supporting listener and you're not on the guest list already, I'm afraid you'll have to wait for the next one. But I do these a couple of times a year. They are an unannounced bonus of being a supporting listener of the Tom Woods Show. I pay for all the food, all the entertainment, and we just have a great old time. So if you're not a supporter of the Tom Woods Show, look at all the things you're missing out on. I just throw parties and I don't even mention that as a bonus. Oh, by the way, you're getting a free party. So check it out, supportinglisteners.com. You look at all the goodies you get for supporting the Tom Woods Show and now realize there are extra things that aren't even on that list. Oh my goodness. So check it out at supportinglisteners.com and I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at Podsworth.com.